The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 21.
Yo, welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy's free, but the food's on you.
Hello folks, Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back, thanks for being here, happy to have you here. Some preliminaries before we get into the show. Click over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, and follow me on the various social media icons. Also, support the show by becoming a patron with my Patreon. I am interested in upgrading the show with some equipment, particularly a new mic, and anything you can do to help get there would be much appreciated. Please do share the show with your friends with your favorite social media platforms. And when you do listen on your favorite podcatcher, take a moment to rate and give a positive review of the show. Those ratings and reviews help move the show up and get more people listening. And the more people who listen, the more people who get cooking. The field of candidates running for president is already getting crowded, and that's just the Democrats. How can you sort out the silly from the serious? Subscribe to Liberty Classroom through my affiliate link, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback, and learn economics and politics and history on your commute to work. Bite back against the wrong or missing information from your government school education with Liberty Classroom, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. Today, my guest is Lawrence W. Reed, president of FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education. I'll give Lawrence a moment to tell us about his career. Lawrence travels the world in his current job giving speeches about economics. However, it is about his travels and visits to other countries that I wish to talk to him today. Welcome, Lawrence. Thank you so much for being on.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Dan.
Before we get into talking about food, as it happens, you have quite a name for yourself in your own field. So for those of us who don't know who you are, give us a little bit of background about who Lawrence Reed is.
Okay. I'm an economist and historian. I am the president at the present time of the Foundation for Economic Education and have been for 10 and a half years. I say at the present time because we're in the process of searching for a successor, which we hope to announce sometime in the next few months. Before joining FEE in 2008, I had a long history with the organization as its board chairman for 3 years. 9 years as a member of the board and as a speaker and writer going back as early as 1977. And before becoming president of FEE in 2008, I was also for 21 years the president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Michigan, where prior to that I taught economics for 7 years at Northwood University.
All right. Well, we're not going to use almost any of that information today because we're going to talk about something that you probably don't get asked very much about, which is your travels, which probably is of interest to a lot of people, but really particularly the food on those travels. And so you've told me the extent of your travels, but just let everybody know where you've been.
Okay. I've been to 83 countries to date. The first time I went overseas, except for a fishing trip to Canada, was 1985. And so what is that, almost 35 years? 83 countries, many of them many times, like 7 times to Russia, 5 of those when it was part of the old Soviet Union, many times to China and to almost every country in Latin America, in Western Europe, and Eastern Europe as well. I guess 6 continents. The only one I haven't been to is Antarctica. And I really enjoy foreign travel. I have a lot of friends in many countries. It's always great to see them. And one of the things I most like to do when I go to a foreign country is to immerse myself in the local culture as much as possible. I don't run to the first McDonald's I see. I want to eat, and I the local food. I want to meet the local people and get off the tourist beaten path as much as I can.
Well, that's, I wouldn't run to McDonald's anywhere, so I appreciate that. So you and I are Facebook friends, and I have seen some of your photographs from your travels, and I remember seeing some of them from Russia, and I was impressed by the quality of how the food appeared. It just really looked like very, very fine dining. And so one of my thoughts, and I will preface the thought with a profound ignorance of world affairs. I'm not a world traveler. I have been to Canada, but you know, I too am from Michigan, so going to Canada is just a weekend excursion. So coming from this uninformed place that communist countries are inherently just dirt poor, those restaurants that serve this fine cuisine, my first thought is, who is the food for? So correct me if I'm wrong, and I probably am, are the people in this communist country just dirt poor, or do these restaurants that make nice-looking food have a domestic market?
Well, Russia has come a long way by many measures since the old Soviet days, and the photos that you may have recently seen, or even 2 years ago when I was at this same restaurant in Moscow, they were of a very fine dining food and place, but you know that didn't exist except for the party apparatchiks and foreign dignitaries 30 years ago. The restaurant that you may have seen the more recent pictures from, because I was there in November of last year and March of 2016, was from the White Rabbit. And oh my gosh, that's one of my favorite restaurants now in all the world. It's rated by, I think, the Michelin people as the 17th best restaurant on the planet. I've been there twice now, and they specialize in beef tongue, which I would normally never order, or I have never ordered before, but it is absolutely exquisite. And if anybody's listening and thinks that it must be incredibly expensive, it's not. In fact, the first time I was there in March of 2016, three of us had our drinks, we had appetizers, we had our entrees, we had desserts, we had the whole works. Three of us in this beautiful restaurant on the 16th floor, I think it is, of a building in Moscow, built like a greenhouse at the top so you can see in all directions. The total bill only came to $220 for three of us. So it's very inexpensive, but just fantastic. I think, though, that the diet of the ordinary Russian has made dramatic progress and improvements since the communists disappeared in 1991. So I think everything is generally better in Russia, although I certainly, as a libertarian, decry a lot of the authoritarian impulses of the current government. But the food is getting better all the time.
I think, I mean, not to tread into your territory, but I think that the idea that conflict is the heart of economics, and the conflict being, you know, dealing with the infinite wants and the finite resources, I think there's also a kind of an economy in the food culture. And it can probably, we could take culture down to as small as a city block. I don't have firsthand knowledge, but having spent a lot of time watching TV shows, knowing that in the little Jewish section in Rome, you can get things there that across the street you're not going to get, because they don't do Cacio Fiala Judea, for example, across the street. So there is, I guess, a real micro food culture, but then we can get into the bigger stuff. One of the things I'm sort of wondering about, and now that the financial economics of Russia are improving for most of the people, there is an ability to have a wider exposure to different foods. But when there wasn't that, and this applies to anybody who's experiencing limited financial resources, you have a core food culture. So I know that the Russians, they had a sideboard of hors d'oeuvres called zakuski. The Polish have the gołąbki's, the Hungarian goulash. You get Viennese desserts, which is, I guess, maybe an indulgence. But how do you find and this is maybe a hard question to answer, but how do you find through the thick and thin of times they maintain this food culture?
I think, and this is probably true everywhere, that people pass down from one generation to the next a lot of aspects of their family food culture. And so family is probably the single most important source of whatever any nation's food culture may be. And, you know, that's very hard for even the state to regulate. Families will do their best for themselves, no matter what the circumstances. And only if, you live in a situation where the government is engineering mass famines, as the Russian government did, Soviet government, back in the Ukraine in the 1930s, only in extraordinary circumstances like that can the state have the effect of nullifying the food culture that gets its stamp right at the start in families. I remember, though, I interviewed the manager of the first McDonald's restaurant that opened in Moscow in the very late 80s. And it had only been open for a couple months at that point. And one of the things I learned, and I saw it, was that the introduction of private enterprise in the restaurant business, whether it be from foreign countries like McDonald's or even domestic restaurants, had a salutary effect on the way people related to each other. And every libertarian, I think, should be excited about this. It's one of the things that private restaurants do. What I'm talking about is this manager of the McDonald's told me that the first customers who came, and they lined up for blocks to get McDonald's food, they were shocked at the training that the McDonald's employees had. You walked in, they let 50 people in at a time, and they had something like 28 registers, as I remember. And they were immediately greeted by clerks who said things like, "Can I help you? What can I do for you? Would you like ketchup with that? You know, or would you like fries with that?" And the reason they found that shocking, so many customers, is that they were accustomed to state restaurants with surly waiters who basically treated them like you get treated at the DMV or the post office quite often, where, you know, we don't really care about you. You're a customer, but that just means you're a burden to us. If you weren't here, we'd get paid anyway.
Larry, let's take a minute out for a word from one of my affiliates. Try the World is the first gourmet tour around the world with no planes or passports necessary. Visit culinarylibertarian.com/worldfood to subscribe. Subscribers receive a gourmet box of ingredients from various countries such as France or Brazil every month. Discover a dozen of the best gourmet and cultural finds in each box, accompanied by a beautifully illustrated culture guide explaining how to enjoy the food. Try the World also offers a snack box subscription with 5 snacks from 5 different countries. Check out the gift boxes and shop to purchase items also. Visit culinarylibertarian.com/worldfood. That's culinarylibertarian.com/worldfood to subscribe. Now, let's get back into the show.
I think the introduction of private restaurants in Russia has actually had a wonderful effect of soothing tensions, bringing people together, encouraging politeness. I mean, that's what capitalism often does for people. You have to serve your customer or you disappear.
Yeah, or you won't have a customer.
Yeah.
I think that surly waiter is kind of the... And movies certainly contribute to this, but I think that's sort of the stereotype idea we get of what a communist system would be. And I guess if that's what they're doing to the customers, they're not helping their case.
Yeah, and to contrast that now with any restaurant in Russia, I don't know that there are any, certainly if there aren't many state-owned restaurants these days. I think they're overwhelmingly private. And wherever you go, you find people providing friendly service. And that really, we take that for granted in places like the United States. But it was a new thing for generations of Russians when the communists disappeared in the early 90s.
Well, that's hopeful, and that's exciting stuff. So travel brings about, and maybe even for a seasoned traveler, there's still possibly the excitement of the mystery of the place. And I think, and certainly in my case, there's a misunderstanding of a people, no matter where you go and no matter who those people are. One of the things I'm curious, have you found that in terms, maybe even in restaurants, but more at people's homes or just in general, does food serve as this vehicle to bring people together, regardless of politics or class or economics?
I think so. I've seen that happen in many countries. Food is universal. We all like it. We all eat it. And when we sit around a table eating food, it's kind of hard to hate the person right across from you. I mean, it's a pleasant experience. So I think by and large, food is something that helps to bring people together. I would caution too, even though we talked about a very fancy fine dining restaurant in Moscow that I particularly like, I wouldn't encourage travelers to only go to such places. Eat with ordinary people as much as you can at the restaurants where ordinary people eat. When I go to Poland, which is one of my favorite countries in all the world, I love going to out-of-the-way, non-touristy, locally owned restaurants. And one of the things I typically order, believe it or not, Poles themselves kind of look down upon and say, oh, why would you want that peasant food? It's called bigos, and it's a kind of savory sauerkraut with sausage. And oh my gosh, that's one of the reasons I like going to Poland. You can't get it here. But I've had many great conversations with people, not all of the same political views, around a dinner table in one country after another.
Well, that, I guess, gives Americans hope for Thanksgiving time.
Yeah.
that seems to be the opposite experience. You know, there's all sorts of funny memes being posted around Thanksgiving time about libertarians and, you know, throwing in the explosives at the dinner table. And
yeah, or I've seen a few memes that bring up the an image from an old Three Stooges episode where, you know, they're throwing pies at each other. But that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, no, although I think the sentiment does have some validity to it.
I would enjoy a good pie fight for as well.
Oh, I never had one, but I always wanted one. So I guess maybe someday. As you've experienced the world and... This is uniquely an American thing, and so the idea is talking about food rights. And to people who aren't aware, this may sound like a just completely absurd idea, but recently in Tennessee, one of the state legislators has proposed a bill that would forbid farmers from drinking raw milk from their own cows. There was a book a few years ago talking about food rights cases in raw milk and raw dairy and raw poultry, and the story of a judge in Wisconsin that decided that you, as the grower of food, do not have a right to the food of your labor. Is this something that you have found, or would the Europeans and Chinese and Poles just look at this as craziness?
No, I've seen that in a lot of different places. In Western Europe, in recent decades, you've seen this kind of totalitarian impulse, micromanaging people's lives on the part of do-gooders with political power. I think it's reprehensible. The fact is, we need to remind people that your body is your body. It's nobody else's. And government should be involved at all as if somebody perhaps has deceived you and poisoned you or broken their contract with you and delivered something that you didn't expect or contract for, you know, those kinds of things. Force, violence, fraud, deception, actually doing harm to another person. Otherwise, it's your body. You have a right that you are born with to put into it what you want, so long as in the process you don't do harm to another person's equal right to his or her body, his or her life, property, and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, once you start down this slippery slope of saying, well, we don't think people should have raw milk, then we don't think they should have this or that, and before you know it, you've got government prescribing your diet and your menu for you. That's the road to tyranny, and I think everybody ought to resist that. It's none of government's business to tell you what you can or cannot put in your body voluntarily.
Well, I agree with you on that, and so let me ask you a follow-up, which maybe doesn't get further explanation. How ought libertarians think about food?
I think that's a fascinating question, by the way. I think we should rejoice in the fact that food and the way we deal with it as individuals, as human beings, is a manifestation of the incredible uniqueness and originality that that is a descriptor, in fact, of every person. No two people who have ever lived on this planet have been precisely the same. Every single one of us is extraordinarily unique. And we express that uniqueness in a lot of different ways, by our choices, basically choices more than anything else, I guess. And one of those important areas of choice is the food we decide to prepare and to ingest. So I rejoice in the fact that there are such incredible varieties of food and the way it's prepared, reflective of the fact that we as individuals are not robots. There's no one food that we all must eat or should eat or do eat. We do all sorts of things to it, and that's a manifestation of an extraordinary feature of human nature, which is our individuality.
Well, I think that was a good springboard off the other one. That was so. Thank you.
My pleasure. If I could add,
yes.
Sometimes, of course, this means that we put things in our body that somebody else may disapprove of. Well, that's just too bad. I mean, this is what freedom in a free society is supposed to be about. I was just at the grocery store this morning, and I saw something that I had to chuckle about. In fact, I bought a can. It's Reese's Peanut Butter Cup Dairy Whipped Topping in a can, like whipped cream. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I love Reese Cups, but this country's going to the hogs. When, if you don't have the energy to actually eat a Reese Cup, now you can just buy a can of this stuff, open your pie hole and spray them in. I did get it, and it's good, but it's not exactly fine dining.
Ugh, no, not exactly fine dining. So this is maybe an interesting question, given how at least Russia has changed in the last 20, 30 years. But supposing that a city is a city is a city, in provincial towns, do you find that there is an increased division of labor, whereas the butcher only does four-legged animals, and there's someone down the street doing two-legged winged animals, and then you have a fishmonger? Or is there still, in some places, the butcher does everything that breathes that's not a human, and that the candle maker also is the butcher? Is there...
Well, yeah, this is not something I've given a lot of thought to, so my answer will be more anecdotal and a sort of a gut feeling. But I think cities, just by definition, tend to take the division of labor to they're further along in the division of labor by just very definition. People living close to each other, they have the opportunity to specialize more, and so they do. In rural areas, yeah, there's more, if not self-sufficiency, at least a lot of people do a lot of different things to keep the farm going or whatever. So I find that the division of labor is still apparent everywhere, but it's more advanced typically in cities. But I encourage people, when you go to a country, don't think you've experienced it if you just go to the cities. Get out in the countryside if you can. I went to Mongolia a few years ago, and in the capital of Ulaanbaatar, you have one level of of living and of food quality and what have you, and you have more options for fine dining in Ulaanbaatar. But if you really want to experience the country, go out a few miles or even further to the steppes, and you know, as I did, and actually have a dinner in a yurt or a ger, as they sometimes call them, these circular tents that many Mongolians live in. And there you'll experience unbelievable food that you could never have imagined. I've eaten some things that I look back and I think, oh, golly, at the time, I was more than happy to do it. I'm glad I did, but I'm not sure I'd recommend it all.
Well, we're actually going to get to those kinds of topics in just a minute.
Like the national drink in Mongolia is called Airag, A-I-R-A-G. It really does require a taste that you have to develop. It's fermented horse milk. And I drank a great big mug of it because it was presented to me as a kind of token of friendship, and I didn't want to offend. I didn't particularly care for it, but I sure appreciated the kindness that came with it and the opportunity to give it a try. But I like everything, but Airag is not high on my list.
I read on your blog your post about wine. So I'm going to deduce that you are still not the wine aficionado you want to be. So tell me a little bit about the impetus for that post and what's changed since you wrote it.
Yeah, this was a month or two ago. I like red wine. I like white wine, too. I actually started many decades ago drinking wine and drinking mostly white, and then gravitated to red, mainly because the more I read, the more I discovered that red, you know, is probably better for you. And you get the whole grape, not just the innards when you drink red wine. But I've never tasted all the things that wine aficionados say you should taste in a glass of wine. And I, hey, maybe it's just me. You know, maybe I still have a peasant palate. I don't know. But I read on a flight to Brazil last fall the menu that was served in the business class section. And it the descriptions of the wines just broke me up. One of them said this particular wine contained notes of coffee, red licorice, honeysuckle, earthy truffles, and leather. And I thought, leather? I mean, who wants to eat or drink liquefied leather? So I tried to taste those things, but I just couldn't. It just tastes like wine to me. It's grapes with a zing to them. And then another description said this wine was succulent and supple with a tense body. Tense, as if it had some kind of nervous hang-up. A tense body of bright, wild strawberry, dried lavender, Asian spice, and crushed rock, and finishes in a gorgeous dabble of white pepper. And I drank that whole glass, and I never tasted a strawberry or lavender or any Asian spice, let alone crushed rock. So I wrote this column because I was, I just thought, hey, here's an opportunity for a little levity. I think wine descriptions go off the deep end, but I'm not anti-wine. I drink a lot of it.
Now, I think you're right about wine descriptions having the tendency to just be ridiculous, and it's almost as if the technical writers have a quota to fill on how idiotic they can be and how many descriptors they can come up with.
I picked up a copy of Wine Enthusiast magazine after that flight to read what it had to say about such things. It was page after page of this stuff, and I made a note of some of the more extraordinary things that people wrote that they tasted in wines. Things like wood smoke, blackened toast, butter cookies, clarified butter as opposed to just regular butter, and roasted beef in blackberry sauce. A cigar box, and one even said it tasted like a barnyard.
As if that's a selling point.
And in a complimentary way.
Well, I worked at a wine tasting room a few years ago, and as probably with all things that have the opportunity for a level of expense and artist's appeal, Wine certainly is that, although it can be for the common person or you can spend $10,000 on a bottle of wine. There is a snootiness that comes, and sometimes very feigned. And it was a challenge to present these wines to taste to the people who were convinced they knew more about the wines than the maker knew about the wines. And as the guy behind the counter, you just smile and nod your head, but thinking to yourself, well, you know, it's you're bringing more to this party than there really is there. And I think your point about the winemaker descriptions is the same.
Yeah, to the folks who, the good folks who write such descriptors, I would just encourage them to lighten up a little bit, get real, and maybe break out a bottle of birch beer, you know, which is a soft drink that not many people know of, but I love it. Or Calvin Coolidge's favorite soft drink, which was Moxie, and you can still get it, but I think only in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, where he was from. It tastes like cough syrup, but I like it.
I'm not familiar with that soft drink.
Yeah, Moxie, M-O-X-I-E. Maybe you can get it online, I don't know, but they still sell it in the Coolidge Family General Store right there in a tiny little hamlet of Plymouth Notch, Vermont, and it was the president's favorite drink.
Wow. Well, when we were kids, and I'm from Detroit, and so Verner's ginger ale is, I think, still there. Maybe it's gone, but...
No, I think it's still there. I lived in Michigan 30 years, and I know it was always very popular.
Oh, well, then that way, every time I got the slightest sniffles, out came the Verner's, and my mom gave me here's a can of Verner's, and drink the Verner's ginger ale.
And that killed off the sniffles?
I think it was probably more placebo effect than actual medicine. But, I mean, so you build this... So this is one of the things that's really powerful in food, and we're not going to get to it today too much, but the whole Proustian idea of the almost gets into semiotics, the image of the thing versus the actual thing. And if you remember at the end of Ratatouille, the food critic eats the dish of Ratatouille, and the first bite, he's instantly transported to being 4 or 5 years old, at his mom's kitchen, and food has this incredible power of time travel where we can be in a whole other place and a whole other time just by the smell and the flavor of the thing. And one of the ways that's developed is your mom gives you Verner's ginger ale when you're sick.
Yeah.
And you feel better, and suddenly you have this thing.
Yeah.
So for Proust, it was the Madeleine cookie, but it worked. Everybody has their own whatever that moment is, and you can't force it. As a chef cooking for many years, I had a couple of people who volunteered to tell the wait staff, and the wait staff remembered to tell me that this was as good as grandma's at some other point. And when you get a compliment like that, you think, grandma, it's like, wait a minute, you're missing the boat. What this person is saying is you've just made his life.
Yeah.
Because you've just made a dish that reminds him or her of childhood at grandma's house, and how you can't beat that. That's the biggest compliment you can get.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned the movie Ratatouille. It's between Ratatouille and Ants. Those are my two favorite animated films of all time. And I would guess that you could probably maybe already have discussed Ratatouille on your program many times.
Well, funny enough, I spoke to the actual Anarchy Boys about, actually the boy, because the other guy was out sick, but we did a version of Ratatouille.
Oh, did you really?
I'll put a link to that. Yeah, I'll put a link to that show on today's show notes page, which will be culinarylibertarian.com/21.
Hey, fantastic.
And that'll be my appearance on Actual Anarchy podcast.
That's great. Yeah, that's a fantastic movie.
I agree. So let's move a little bit to something a little bit more interesting. Well, not less interesting, a little bit lighter. So in your travels around the world, how is American food perceived as you understand it?
Oh, I think there's probably a very broad perspective there, depending on where you are. I think, generally speaking, the French would probably turn their noses up for the most part at so-called American.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah, American cuisine. And, you know, for a long time, people, maybe to a great extent still, turn their nose up at British cuisine. We think of it as just, fish and chips. But actually, British cuisine can be quite good. I think every country has, if you know where to go and know what to ask for, has great food. Some of these stereotypes, I think, are not really warranted. But by and large, American food probably isn't thought of, generally speaking, as well as we think of French or Italian. They've just been at it a lot longer, and, there's something exotic about foods from those countries. So we're probably not thought of as a haven for fine cuisine, but we really are.
Well, I think you're probably right on several points. And one of the first challenges to the question, which is another show, is what exactly is American food? And so that, with, depending how you count things, either 50 regions or at least a good dozen, it's a hard thing to nail down, because you're not going to get chow chow in Hawaii and you're not going to get poi in Alabama. So we have to figure out what it is we mean by that. But that's another show.
That's right. We are a polyglot melting pot kind of country. And so we've got all kinds of food. And being now a Southerner by transplant here in Georgia, I've always loved barbecue, but now I love it more than ever, now that I've discovered some of the best barbecue in the world here in the Atlanta area. That might be, if not uniquely American, at least there is a well-known and renowned American barbecue genre, for sure.
Yes, and notwithstanding Texas, I think you never had a barbecue until you got to Georgia.
Yeah, may well be. But boy, there are great places here. Right here in my little town of Noonan, we've got at least two fantastic barbecue restaurants. And my favorite, maybe of them all, is Fox Brothers up in Atlanta. It's just really, I always tell people, when you come to Atlanta, you've got to stop at Fox Brothers for the barbecue.
Oh, well, they'll appreciate that. So you've answered my next question, which I didn't ask, which was, what is your favorite American food and who makes it? So we've gotten that part down. Do you have a favorite ethnic food?
Yeah, I think when I've been asked that, I usually say Italian. I love cheese. I eat probably four times the average per capita amount of cheese. And Italians are good with cheese. And I love tomato sauce. So I think Italian is way up there. But there's almost nothing in the way of an ethnic food that I don't like, which is a great attribute to have, I think, if you travel the world, as I have, because I can go anywhere, eat just about anything, and find reason to like it.
Well, all right. So then that brings up the next question. Are you a picky eater at all? And are you a picky eater when you travel?
No, I'm the least picky eater in the world. And every time anybody invites me to dinner and they say, is there anything you can't eat or don't want to eat or are allergic to? I say, absolutely no. Whatever you make, I will enjoy. As long as it's not too hot. You know, I don't want anything that's off the chart on the Scoville scale.
Fair enough.
But otherwise, I eat everything and almost always like everything.
Well, you're a good guest to have.
I'm not. Maybe that means my palate is not very discriminating, but food just tastes great to me. I've never been picky.
Well, that's okay. So what you possibly lack in palate affinity increases your hospitality as a guest. So it's to your favor, I suppose.
Well, thank you. It certainly serves me well in other countries. I've eaten some strange things from snake and bird's nest soup in China to the irag I mentioned in Mongolia. I mean, you name it. And that I didn't care for, but most things I really like.
Okay, so you've already told us the White Rabbit in Moscow is one of your favorites, maybe the best. What are You can exclude that if you want to. What are your top three favorite restaurants or dishes that you've experienced?
Top three restaurants, that'd be tough because I can think of fantastic meals, but I don't necessarily remember the name of the restaurant. I had way back in 1985, the first time I went to China, I had Peking duck for the first time. And I still remember that meal like it was yesterday. It was just absolutely fantastic. The plum sauce, the scallions, the duck, and the little pancakes, you roll it all in.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, that was just fantastic. I've never had Peking duck in my life since that was as good as that first time, but I couldn't tell you what the name of the restaurant was.
You know, I got to tell you that, and Peking duck is fantastic. I've never had the best one, but those little scallion pancakes, oh my gosh, those things are good.
Absolutely, yep. I remember having a salmon in Monaghan, Ireland. I was driving from, I'd just taken a ferry from Scotland over to Belfast, and then was driving from Belfast down into the Republic of Ireland and ultimately to the southern part, and took the ferry back over to England, and came through a little town called Monaghan, where I had the most savory, buttery, delicious salmon I've ever had. And every time I order salmon today, I think of that. And that's probably 25 years ago or more.
Nice. So excluding IRAG, what's the worst thing you've ever eaten?
The first time I ever had kimchi.
Really?
I was in South Korea. And, I'm not big into super spicy stuff, but boy, that was, even for kimchi, I think that was just really off the chart, hot and spicy. I didn't expect it and left a bad taste for quite a while. So I haven't touched kimchi since.
There was, in Tallahassee, it was actually a restaurant supply store, but they also had a small kitchen where they sold the things that they made. And one fellow, they made kimchi. And it wasn't, I'm like you, I don't mind the flavor of spice, but just like nuclear hot, I just don't appreciate that. I don't care for that. It does not please me. So they made a kimchi that was not spicy hot, but oh my gosh, I've never found a kimchi that twinned that one. Is just, I don't even know what he did. It was so simple, but my goodness, was it good.
Well, have you ever been to Poland?
I have not. The closest I got was Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
Ah, okay. Well, again, when you go there, ask for bigos. That's a great dish.
Oh, I will.
Oh, I should tell you too, Dan. This was a big shock and a surprise to me. Last May, for the first time, I went to the Galapagos Islands, which belong to Ecuador. I had speeches in Quito and Guayaquil, and in between, I spent 4 days on the islands. And of course, you go for things like the wildlife and the vegetation. Most people expect there to be almost nothing in the way of settlement, but there really is a really cool little town called Puerto Ayora, about 25,000 people. And I have to say, two of the best dinners I've ever had in my life, I had right there in restaurants on ordinary people were eating at right on the main drag. One of them was pizza. And it was the best pizza I've ever had. Imagine that in the Galapagos. And at the other.
Don't tell the Sicilians.
Yeah. At the other. Yeah. I had the swordfish at the other restaurant. And unlike the swordfish I've had elsewhere, it was less like a steak, a little more fluffy. The texture was a little different. And it was just outstanding. And I just didn't expect such delectable foods in the Galapagos Islands.
Well, that swordfish observation is interesting. It makes me wonder if it wasn't part of the belly.
It might have been. I don't know.
Because that way, the belly's got more fat in it, whereas the muscle, of course, is just pure muscle.
Yeah, that would explain why I liked it so much. Because I know that my taste buds love the fifth taste, I think, called umami.
Well, that was my next question.
Ah, okay. Go ahead.
Well, that's all right. So, well, obviously, in case someone doesn't know, the four main ones are bitter, salty, sour, sweet. And then sort of we've discovered, I think maybe it was the Japanese who sort of identified that last fifth thing of umami, which is, so here's your non-economist question of the day. Can you identify or define umami?
Well, to my understanding, it is the savoriness that you find in things like fatty foods, dairy products. I think it explains why I like cheese so much, because cheese has, typically anyway, most cheeses, a very savory, greasy flavor to it. It's the reason that when I go to a barbecue place, I find the fattiest brisket I can find, because it just imparts such a wonderful flavor. It's also the reason I take Lipitor, I think, for cholesterol. But hey, you know, like I said, as a libertarian, it's my body. I want to put in it whatever I want to enjoy life, even if it shortens it by a few months.
Well, I agree. I think that that's probably a good working definition, and I'm not sure that I'm in a position to add to that. But I am. I would suggest that you see somebody who knows more than your doctor about your health, because you might be getting misinformation.
Okay.
Well, just because I've done a few episodes, I talked with a couple of people, and so anyway, we'll talk about that later. But something not food related, but just interesting. What's your favorite sound?
My favorite sound?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Nobody's ever asked me that. I would have to say, okay, I'm thinking of several. Now, how do I narrow it down? I guess I would say maybe the sound of Beethoven's Ode to Joy.
Ah, that's a good sound.
Because, oh my gosh, yeah. Every time I listen to it, it brings tears to my eyes. I know, of course, its importance to people who believe in liberty. And also, I just am amazed that a mortal being could have composed such a beautiful piece. So that certainly is way up there, if not my number one sound.
That's a good sound. What sound or noise do you hate?
Fingernails on a chalkboard. Kamala Harris announcing her presidential campaign.
Oh, my God.
Nancy Pelosi at the at a podium.
Rimshot time. Badoomch.
Yeah, those would be among my least.
The fingernails on the chalkboard, I'm pretty sure it was one of the Peter Sellers Pink Panther movies where he put on a bear claw and then on the chalkboard as torture. And
oh.
I don't remember. I think that was the movie. I honestly don't remember which one, but it's never really bothered me the way it bothers some. But I can appreciate that it is a displeasant.
Oh, yes. I can't at the moment think of anything worse than that.
Or an unsettling sound. Well, I would expand your signaling out politicians to pretty much any time they open their mouth, but that's just the cynic in me.
Well, I have some of the same sympathies, I'm sure, that most of the time.
I'm sure you do.
They're spouting nonsense as they're talking about what they're going to do for you. And all I can think about is what they have to do to me in order to do anything. For me.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Stop helping, please. Please, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have the same problem in Oregon. Look how we're helping you. No, you can stop.
Is that where you live? I didn't realize that that's where you are.
Yep. I'm in Oregon. Who knows where I'll be next year?
Okay. That's the home of the Cascade Policy Institute, as I recall.
Yes. I think that it is.
Yep, a free market think tank, I think founded by an old friend of mine, Steve Buckstein, still there. It's a great outfit. It's a tough state to work in, though.
And they're getting worse. They want rent control and a dozen new taxes. And
oh, my gosh. Isn't it one of only two states, the other being New Jersey, that still makes it illegal in most places for you to pump your own gas?
Yes, although... So there was last year during the election, in some rural areas, now you can pump your own gas. And just the expected amount of crazies came out of the woodwork saying, this old lady is going to die because she has to pump her own gas. And, you know, I lived in Michigan and Florida where you pump your own gas. And I've never once in many years on this planet seen anybody fall over dead from pumping gas. It just the almost hypochondriac responses to change is just, my gosh, people, just think for a second, please.
Absolutely. Well, that's the kind of unbelievably stupid and intrusive law that I'd love to see people just here's something for you to organize, Dan. Why don't you organize a statewide one-day pump your own gas day and just get everybody in Oregon who to just pump their own gas anyway in defiance of the law, and maybe the politicians will get the message.
Interesting idea. I think it would work. My concern would be with all of the other noise going on with Kate and her minions, would they hear it?
Yeah, I know it wouldn't be easy, but boy, I'd love to see it.
Well, I'm on some Oregon Facebook pages, and I'm reassured that my legislators are doing their job because they post pictures of the letters they've written. And when they get really mad, then they write another letter. Well, all right. Thank goodness you're there writing letters. Whew. Sorry. Was that cynical?
Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to a pump your own gas day in Oregon that organized by you. And if they throw you in jail, I'll bake you a cake and bring it in with a hacksaw in it.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's see what I can do. I saw recently that one of your books was translated into Portuguese.
Yes.
That is very, very cool.
Hey, thank you. That was Excuse Me, Professor, which has 50 myths that progressives typically pronounce about capitalism and free markets, and it provides a response to each of them. But they changed the title in Portuguese too. This is in Brazil. They changed it to Excuse Me, Socialist. And I got a chuckle out of that.
Really?
Yeah. I'm sure the publisher down there thought that might have more impact given the current climate in Brazil. So I applaud it.
Well, all right. Certainly take their word for it. Am I correct that you also have a book recently out or due out soon?
Well, the last book came out two and a half years ago called Real Heroes, subtitled Inspiring True Stories of Courage, Character, and Conviction. It has about 40 chapters in it of each one on a great person who left the world a better or freer place, and in some cases, both. I have ideas in the works, nothing on the drawing boards firmly yet, but I expect in coming months and years, I'll be cranking out a lot of articles and several more books. That's what I'd like to do more than anything else as I slide into a kind of semi-retirement.
Well, that's a good plan. How can people find your articles, and do you have a website for us?
Yes, two websites. The website of the Foundation for Economic Education. I certainly have a lot of stuff there that I think I first started writing for fee in 1977. And everything we've ever published since the 1950s is on that site. That's fee, FEE.org. And then I have my own personal website, which contains mostly stuff I've written for fee, but a lot of other things too. And that is simply Lawrence W. Reed, R-E-E-D.com, LawrenceWReed.com.
Okay, excellent. And I will put both of those links also on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/21. One other thing I wanted to ask you before we go is, what languages do you speak fluently?
Some would say none. I think I'm reasonably good at English, but my second language is so far down the list, it's hardly worth mentioning. But when I go to a Spanish-speaking country, my Spanish sort of comes back a bit. But I usually use an interpreter or local friends who help me out wherever I go.
Okay. It's something I was just thinking about. It's like, well, if all these places you go, sure, but perhaps you've picked up some pidgin bits here and there.
Yeah, a little conversational stuff, even Russian, but not really very extensive at all. I pick up some vocabulary, the alphabet. You know, if you go to Russia, and if you just know the alphabet, you'll be amazed at how many words you can decipher. So it helps to know that.
Well, that's probably good advice for anyone anywhere.
Yeah. When I went to Japan, I took a course in Japanese before going. And even though I've forgotten most of it, it proved to be very valuable. And I can still count from 1 to 10 in Japanese. Ichi, ni, san, shi, do, roku, shichi, hachi, kuju. There you go.
Excellent. Awesome. All right. Well, Larry, this has been a pleasure. And I don't think I would have gotten any of this information on fee, so I'm glad we did this.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. It's been fun, and I applaud you for your efforts. When I first learned of your website, I thought it was very intriguing, still do, and I'll help promote it. When you post this, let me know, and I'll put it on my Facebook page.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. That cutoff at the end there was me accidentally stopping the recording, so Larry and I didn't have a chance to say goodbye, but I assure you, he did in fact say goodbye. I'll have links to Larry's websites mentioned on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/21, as well as links to the two books Larry mentioned, the English versions, of course. For those interested, I have the podcast audio posted on YouTube. It's not video, but it is sometimes just easier to let the tube play while you're doing something else. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/podcast YT to check it out. culinarylibertarian.com/podcast YT. See you next week. That cutoff at the end there was me accidentally stopping the recording, so Larry and I didn't have a chance to say goodbye, but I assure you, he did in fact say goodbye.